Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 24, delivered on November 14th.
Today, net present value and internal rate of return. Before I do that, we'll try a shot at the markets and see what's going on. As far as you're concerned, how's this day looking, sir? How about a little bit bad? Yeah, be a little more specific here. It's on the edge of a significant down day with the NASDAQ leading out at coming up on 0.5% down. The other markets are down about 0.25%. The Russell is up, though, small caps and all of that. Now, of course, as the equities are shed, the money will move somewhere, and at least some of it is going into gold and silver, the metals, and we see the bonds are easing out, too. So there is a flight out of equities and a flight out of debt securities as well, which is pushing interest rates up, of course, as bond prices go down. So we got a couple of not very good news events going on. Now the question would be, well, why is this happening? Well, that's a more difficult thing to call. What's the motivator? Well, it's just more or less the markets are in a sour mood. Well, I didn't mean to do that. Let me go back here. Just really quickly, having a look at how the market has been behaving in the morning. The bears were leading it off on the first pass, of course. Well, I'm sorry, the bulls had a little spike at the beginning, and the bears came in. And then we had these couple of bumps upward, but then it fell off a cliff just before the lunch hour, as you can see there. As the bulls came in, you can see that there was a bull attack right there. And then the bears, a bear attack right there, pushing securities prices down. And then we had a little bit of a bull spike trying to rally off the low. But in general, it doesn't look that good. Now, looking at the year to date, just very quickly, we still see that the S&P 500 has rising bottoms and, so far, still intermediate and longer rising tops. So that is a technical indicator that it's still not in a really bad situation, although this volume is remaining low, and that's just something that is always concerning, why there is so little trading going on, especially among the heavies on Wall Street. That's something that we still are going to keep an eye on. But as I say, see these rising intermediate tops, just all nice ups, and then you've got the rising troughs too. And as long as they can keep that trend going, we're probably not going to see any kind of a crash. It's when that trend starts to begin to level off or go the other way that we begin to get a little concerned that something bad is happening in the market. Now, as far as the topic today goes, this is a continuation of what you saw on Tuesday, just applications of net present value and a few extensions as well. Let me show you something here. Okay. I'll draw a profile of a net present value profile here. A discount rate and the associated net present value for some project, NPV. And about every project is going to have some place, let's say 1%, 1%, 2, and I'll just run it out here a little ways, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14,
15%, 10% here, and we give a benchmark to 2, 3, 4, 5, and a bench and 5% there. Okay, so now, again, as long as your net present value is positive, well, you're going to accept the project. So if I had used a discount rate of 6%, this would have been a go, this project. I would have said yes, because the net present value would come out to be a positive number. If I had said something like use a discount rate of 12%, well, you would have said no to that. So now, right here is that internal rate of return. And it looks like it's at about 8.5%, 8.5%. Now, there's a very practical use for this. Try this. Madam, you have somehow become the go-to person for finance issues at Megacorp International. Yes, you turned to the dark side. You couldn't resist, you know, the cool white stormtrooper uniforms. Prada, I think so. So I have given you the free cash flows for a project, but I didn't give you the discount rate. I forgot to. Now, you're a little bit concerned about asking me for that because, you know, I'm Darth Vader, and if you irritate me, I can strangle you. So you're just sitting there with these free cash flow numbers. You can't do the net present value if you don't have a discount rate. However, there's something you can do. Suppose that you found out that the NPV, you can run the internal rate of return. You don't need a discount rate to do that. That gives you a discount rate. Okay, you ran the internal rate of return, and it came out to be 8.5%. And so the next day, I come sweeping in. The discount rate, I forgot to tell you, is 10%. Immediately, you can say to me, what?
No.
You reject the project. That's a good use of the internal rate of return, because once you have it, you know that 10% is going to be a negative. You don't even have to run the NPV. You know what's going to happen if the internal rate of return is 8.5% on this project. So that is a use for it, for finding for getting answers before even the whole problem is given to you. That's a good use of the internal rate of return. Here's the evil side of internal rate of return. It's used in a lot of companies. It's called the hurdle rate. We reject any project that does not meet our hurdle rate of 12%. Okay, so now, suppose we have project internal rate of return. Project A has an internal rate of return of 13.6%. Project B has an internal rate of return of 5.2%. Project C has an internal rate of return of 11.6%. And Project D has an internal rate of return of 12.9%. They'll just run the free cash flow analysis, get the IRRs, the internal rates of return, of all the projects that are on the table. And then they compare it to the hurdle rate. In this case, they would say yes to Project A,
at 13.6%, no to Project B at 5.2%, no to Project C at 11.6%, and yes to Project D at 12.9%. The reason they would do this is because Projects C, B and C did not meet the hurdle rate of the firm. Here's a graphic of why that would happen, why that is. Okay, the hurdle rate that they have set out for this company is 12%. Okay, so Project A, I don't know what exactly its NPV profile is, but I do know that it crosses at 13.6%. It crosses the discount rate axis, the horizontal axis. I know it does. That's what internal rate of return means. I don't know how flat it is, how steep it is, but I know that about the profile, which means that at the hurdle rate of 12%, it's a positive NPV project. See it? Then, over here, this B, it crosses, I don't know exactly what its NPV profile looks like, but I do know that the profile crosses the discount rate, the horizontal axis, at 5.2%. Okay, there we go. We say, see, at 12%, this thing is wildly negative. The next one, C, it's close. The profile will be crossing at 11.6%, so at 12%, it's just a little bit negative. Again, no. And finally, we got that Project D at 12.9%, so that'd be crossing the horizontal axis at 12.9, which means that at 12%, it is a positive NPV project. That's how it works. That's the technical line of it. It is a very popular approach. And it has, it has two critical flaws in it. One, the big glaring critical flaw is, where does the 12% come from? It's, in my experience, it's like, well, we just have that. Okay, you set that 12%. Why did you do that? Well, it sounds like a good number. Or, I don't think I want to go into the technical things about how we got... No, you just pulled that out of your butt. It's just one of those things. It's arbitrary. Generally speaking, it's just out there. Now, one way that they can justify, and I've heard this one, and it is sort of... It's sort of okay... is that the hurdle rate is the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. Anything that is positive net present value at the weighted average cost of capital of the firm, well, obviously the project's going to pay for itself in terms of the cost of capital. Okay, we'll buy that one. It's still not particularly good because actually the weighted average cost of capital isn't a very good measure. In 240, we used to teach how to find the marginal cost of capital, which is how much the last dollar that you bring in costs, which is always actually at least but usually greater than what the average dollar you bring in is. But anyway, one way or the other, there you go. That's how it's done. That's a use, and it's a very common use, of the internal rate of return for capital budgeting decision making, for what it's worth. Now, the other flaw in this method goes right back to the internal rate of return itself, which actually is a flawed method. And I'm not going to go into the math of it too deeply, but I am going to bring back something from your dark, dark past. Do you remember... this one's really deep and rough, and it might bring back some, difficult memories. Madam, do you remember somewhere in your dark past in math classes something called polynomials? Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you might remember the worst part of them was factoring, and factoring a quadratic or something like that. I'm going to bring up something here just for a minute to show you not the total theory, but some of the practicalities of where the math of finance crosses into this. And this is where internal rates of return can do you wrong. But to do that, a little bit of algebra. You remember that the degree of a polynomial is the highest power of the independent variable. Somewhere in your past you may have encountered this. So in other words, if I had, let's say, 4x minus 3x cubed plus 2x2 minus 5x squared, that would be a degree 3 polynomial. If I gave you let's say 1 half x squared plus 3 fifths x minus 4 sevenths, that would be a degree 2 polynomial. Negative 4x minus plus 8 would be a degree 1 polynomial, because the highest power is of x is 1 there. The one that is seems to catch people all the time, take the number 9. That is a degree 0 polynomial, because technically there is an implicit x to the 0 power, because x to anything to the 0 power is 1. So in terms of completeness, you were working in polynomial theory and applications from the time you were before you were even in kindergarten, probably. You would learn how to count. 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, you were giving a sequence of degree 0 polynomials. You probably didn't know that. It probably wouldn't have cared one way or the other unless you were a weirdo like I was. But that's how, that's polynomials. Okay, now, let's apply this a little bit more. A degree 0 polynomial, if you graph it, y equals 9, that would be nothing but a horizontal line. Degree 1, this negative 4x plus 8, that would actually be just a straight downward sloping line with the y-intercept of 8. And a slope of negative 4. It'd be a steep line. It'd be a straight line. Okay. A degree 2 polynomial. Oh, I should point out something. Notice that a degree 1 polynomial crosses the axis once. A degree 0 polynomial crosses the y-axis 0 times. Now, a degree 2 polynomial can cross twice, once, or never. So in the possible number of times it could cross is 2. A degree 3 polynomial can cross once, it can cross twice, or it can cross 3 times. But the most it can do is 3. That's an important thing for us in finance. In other words, the degree of a polynomial its roots, its crossings of the x-axis, can be as many as the power of the polynomial. Now, take this over here to an NPV profile. It's a straight line. It's a degree one polynomial. Well, why is that? Because in a typical problem we give you, we have only one time that the sign switches. It switches from negative to positive. The initial cash outflow, and then all positives after that. However, if it switched again, suppose that it would go, and I'll do one here, a quickie right here. Suppose it starts out with an initial cash outflow of $5,000. It then, in the first year, it goes $3,000 up, positive $3,000, and then it goes $5,000 up, and then you have to put new investment into it, and it has a negative $2,500. And then it comes back positive with the new product, and then it finishes up at, let's say, with $2,000 in its terminal year, including salvage value. That's not one sign switch. That's one, two, three sign switches. It's a degree three polynomial. In other words, there is not one internal rate of return. There would be three, quite possibly. We don't know actually how many. It could be one, it could be two, or it could be three crossings. In other words, an internal rate of return used on a mixed cash flow, a mixed sign cash flow, will give you multiple internal rates of return. Well, what do they mean? Nothing. They actually don't mean anything at all. They're completely spurious. Only if you have a single sign switch and a straight line drop on the NPV profile does the internal rate of return have meaning. If you have more than one sign switch, which is actually not that unusual in projects, you could have as many as three internal rates of return. What's worse is that if you put it into a TI-83 calculator or you put it into Excel, you know what's going to happen? It'll give you an answer, and it'll act like that's the only answer. Because if you have, for example, a three sign switch, negative to positive, positive to negative, negative to positive, what would happen is you'd get something like that. And the calculator would give you an answer. It would give you one of these answers. Well, which one would it give you? Well, it depends on where it starts. Calculators and computers take a guess at where the answer is. Or you could even tell, TIs and Excel, you can tell it where to start looking. So if your calculator or Excel started looking right here, it'd see a positive NPV. And then it'd try a number up here and it'd say, oh, that's a negative, so it's got to be in here. And it'd just keep testing back and forth until it found the answer to a certain number of significant digits. But if it decided to look up here, it'd say, oh, it's positive here and it's negative here, so it's got to be in here somewhere. And that's the answer it would give you. In other words, it would give you an answer based upon where it started guessing or where you told it to start looking. So in other words, you got nothing. There is no internal rate of return. Any one of those answers is as good as the other, and every one of them is a useless number. So that is the deepest flaw in internal rate of return. If you have more than one switch in the sign of the cash flow, internal rate of return is an invalid method. It has no use. However, you have some companies just have no adaptation for this. However, finance has given the hardcore internal rate of return fanatics a way around this problem.
Oh, we're never going to use NPV. We'll always use internal rate of return. Okay, fine. If you're going to use it, we've got a way around its fundamental flaw. It's called the modified internal rate of return, MIRR. And I'm going to check something real quick here. I'm going to pull up an 83. I don't think you can do it on an... Well, you can, but you have to do it the hard way. Let me find something here. I'm going to go apps, finance, TVM solver. No, I don't want to do that. What's the matter with me? Apps, finance. And I'm going to run down here and see if it has... The older TIs did not have it. And I'm just going to run... Nope, it doesn't have an MIRR routine. Excel does. Excel does have an MIRR routine. It essentially requires... It says this. Okay. What we're going to do is we are going to take the discount rate for capital projects, and we're going to discount back to the present at that rate. Let's say that rate is 8%. We will discount these back to the present at 8%. Take the present value. Okay? But then we're going to say, okay, the positive cash flows, we're not going to discount back because those are future money for us, internally generated equity. So we're going to take those forward to the end at the reinvestment rate. Let's say that rate, well, how much you get for reinvesting in new projects? Let's say that rate is 12%. So we'll pull all the positive cash flows to the terminal year at the reinvestment rate. And then we'll discount that future value back here to the present. Now, if you're getting fogged, don't worry. It is a little bit complicated. At the capital rate, and compare the number that we got with the present values to the present value of this future value and see which one's bigger. In practice, I'll do this one. I'm not going to do the whole thing. I'll just show you what you would have done. I would have taken, okay, the negative $5,000 plus the negative $2,500, and I would have taken its present value at 1 plus 0.08 to the negative 123, and I would have gotten that number. Well, hell, let me just do it. So I'll take the negative $5,000 plus the present value of the $2,500 discounted back 3 years at 1 plus 0.08 raised to the negative third power. Okay? So the present value of the negative cash flows is $6,984.58. Negative, I'm sorry. We've just pulled all those negatives back.
Now we're saying, okay, but when we make money off this project, we're going to reinvest that in the company. So we're going to haul these 3,000, 5,000, 4,000, and 2,000 up to the future at year 5. So I will, in this case, I'm going to find the future value of $3,000 carried forward at the reinvestment rate, which would be from 3,000, that'd be 1, 2, 3, 4 periods, plus 5,000 positive cash flow, compounded at 1.12, carried forward 1, 2, 3 periods. Now that was a negative, so we got to go over here to year 4, where we had plus 4,000 compounded forward 1 year at 1 year, plus the $5,000, which is sitting there right on the terminal year. We're going to take those numbers. This is a lot like work. Okay, so, yeah, I always do that clear over there where I can't see it. Was that a 5,000? Oh, I 2,000. I was just testing you to see if you were watching. You know what? You ever notice there are never any accountants on Tinder? They know they'll lose. That was hurtful. 3,000. 3,000 open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.12 to the, was that fourth power? To the fourth power, plus 5,000 times 1.1 plus 5,000 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.12, close parenthesis, to the third power, plus, we got that one just before the end, 4,000 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.12, close the parenthesis, to the first power, plus the 2,000. And we get that number. 18,225,20. Well, write this down in your notes. Write it down. What we have essentially done is turned all of the cash flows in the middle into zeros and included them, the negative ones, at the beginning and the positive ones at the end. Now here's the MIRR. I am now going to say, okay, apps, finance, and I'm going to go down here to internal rate of return, 8, and I'm going to say, okay, internal rate of return, the first thing you put in is the initial outflow of cash, which in this case was what? 6984.58. Now, comma, and I'm going to say, just like I always do, here come the positive cash flows. I zeroed out year one, comma. I zeroed out year two, comma. I zeroed out year three, comma. I zeroed out year four, comma. And all of the cash is now in the terminal year five with 18,225.20. 18,225.20. And then I close the braces. I'm done with the positive cash flows. Close the parenthesis. What will come out is called the modified internal rate of return. What I've done is I've turned the mixed cash flow signs into one negative and one positive. So it should be able to give me an answer. 17.33% is the MIRR of this project. 17.33% is the MIRR. Don't make it hard. You can actually, in Excel, all you do is just say equals MIRR. The thing, though, is, and here's the caution, and I'm just going to pull this up for a second. Excel wants you to give the cost of capital discount rate and the reinvestment compounding rate. The book's homework, and I was going to put in a couple that were more complex, but I decided not to. For the ones in your homework, the discount rate for negatives and the compounding rate for the reinvestment positives, they'll be the same. So it would be 8 and 8 or 12 and 12 or whatever. However, if you do this in Excel, it will expect you to give it both of them. Okay, real quick here, just to haul this out for you. I'm going to do year 0, year 1, and then drag it down to year 5. And then I'll put in the numbers real quick here. What was that first number? How much was the initial investment?
Negative 5,000.
Okay. Negative 5,000. What was the next year?
3,000.
Whoops. What was the next year?
5,000.
And then 4,000. Oh, -2,500. Okay, -2,500, 4,000, and 2,000. Okay, now equals MIRR. Now it wants the values, all the values first, and then what Excel calls it is the financing rate, okay, comma, that's my the cost rate. And that was, what was it there, 8%, was it? 0.08, comma, and then the reinvestment rate, 0.12. Now watch this number not be what I got. Okay, survey says, my ass, I didn't do that wrong, did I? I must have made a mistake somewhere in my calculations. Boy, I'm glad I'm not out there where people's money is on the line. But one way or the other, that's the Excel approach to getting how by arbitraging my positions against what's right. Yes, that's how you do it, daggone it. Okay, yeah, but that's how, you notice that in Excel, it's actually a fast process to get it right. So just keep that in mind. It's out there, that kind of method. And it is popular for those who are big fans of the internal rate of return. That's the way it's done.
is just in Excel, you just do an if it's a mixed cash flow, you use an MIRR. You have to, of course, get your financing rate, what I call the cost of capital rate, and your reinvestment rate. Now, the problems in the book are going to have them be the same. I think all of them are. So if you're doing it in Excel, it'd just be the same number here and here. Yeah, I was going to say there was something I was thinking of. Okay, last point, though. Oh, well, there are actually two different issues. Suppose that you had two projects. Now, in the theoretical world of finance, you should be able to finance all projects that have positive net present value. But in reality, you probably won't be able to finance all of your projects. And so, essentially, the rule is fairly simple. You're going to just finance the ones that have the highest net present value, or, if you're an internal rate of return fan, the highest internal rate of return. That's just how it works. And that's sort of where the hurdle rate comes in. You just finance the ones that look the best. There's another problem that can come up. What happens if you have mutually exclusive projects? Like, for example, if you own a plot of land and you could do one of two projects with that land that you have. Now, you can't do both of them. The same thing is, you, sir, are an extraordinarily valuable employee. I could have you work on this project, or I could have you work on this project. They're both great projects. But I can't make another one of you. At least it's kind of expensive to do that whole cloning thing and all that. And, you know, once we let you out of work, no one really wants two of you. But the thing, though, is that would be mutually exclusive projects because they both require the same resources. Then here's what can happen. It's not common, but I actually saw it twice in my practice. And I was so excited, I actually ran the numbers over and over to make sure it was happening. Project A, Project B, NPV, internal rate of return. It can be the case, let's say the Project A is $500, a positive, it's a go. Project B is a positive $350, it's a go. The internal rate of return of Project A is 7.8%. The internal rate of return of Project B is 10.2%. The problem is that they're mutually exclusive projects. I've got to choose one. I can't choose them both. And the two different methods are giving you very different answers. You can see by the NPV method, A is a clearly superior project. The economic profit for it is $150 more than it is for Project B. But by the internal rate of return method, you will see that Project B is very strongly better than Project A. The question would be, whom do you believe? Do you choose A or B? And it really comes down to whether the company is a fan of net present values or internal rates of return. Probably they'll say, well, the internal rate of return of this Project B is stronger, and that's the method we usually use, so we're going to go with Project B rather than Project A. A flaw in these methods. What I teach you is not absolute. And it's got, these methods that we use actually have a deep, deep flaw in them. And we have to go to a very different strategy if we want to look at things from a better perspective. You see, everything that I've done here, you notice that the cash flows that happen early in the project matter more than the cash flows that happen near the end of the project. In other words, in our modern capitalist approach to decisions on investments, we are biased against the long haul. That's just the reality of it. If you look at it from this short-term perspective, most of you are probably a little bit crazy spending all of this negative cash flow for 4 years to crawl out of the hole in the out years, because the discounted present value of those out years is less than the present value of the negative cash flows right here and now in years 1 through 4 of your adult lives. In other words, we in corporate America, we decide against projects that don't pay off very early. In other words, we are actually still stuck in the medieval Renaissance thinking of payback periods. How do we deal with that? Unfortunately, things that we are now looking at aren't going to pay off for many, many years. But when they do pay off, the payoffs will be staggering, and they will support and benefit civilization. Things like colonizing other planets, moving out to the stars, that kind of stuff. Creating sustainability isn't something that's going to happen in 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years. Sustainability is going to take us 50 years if we live that long. There are asteroids that we can mine. Hell, there's an asteroid that's made of gold. It's insane. But it's going to take us a long, long time to get to that thing. So, in other words, our thinking has to be different when civilization is on the line, or when extraordinary things are going to take years and years to actually develop. Because NPV and IRR are going to say, don't go, don't do it, never, don't even imagine it. You begin to see the threads of how we rethink problems if you take my derivatives course, where we don't think of things as assets so much as we think of the future as options, and we're paying for a bet on something good to happen far down the line. That's another course. If you're crazy, you'll take my derivatives course. I welcome you to it. But other than that, just keep in mind that you're going to do NPVs and IRRs, or you're going to be affected by them in your business lives, and they do have that sort of, at the end of the day, kind of like bias against the long term, the future. I'm going to give you a quiz now, and then that's all I'll have for you. I thank you.